Good evening. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, which is a weekly lecture series free and open to the public. So if this is new to you, I hope you will get online at themodern.org and check out the schedule for the fall season. Next week, we are off for Yom Kippur, but we will be back on the 29th with the poet, sound artist, and author Latasha N. Nevada Diggs. Be sure to look into the work of Latasha Diggs if you aren't already familiar. It is sure to be, I think, a memorable evening based on everything I've gathered about her and her work. My introduction to Latasha Diggs was none other than the exhibition catalog, Kehinde Wiley, A New Republic, thanks to the ingenious decision to include the writing of a variety of cultural commentators, including poets, fiction writers, media personalities, critics, and art historians in the catalog by tonight's guest, the curator of the exhibition, Eugenie Tesai, and the artist Kehinde Wiley. Miss Diggs has two remarkable contributions, which are a very good start in understanding her capacity for insight and her very forthright presentation. So I suggest checking out the catalog, which is available in the Modern store. You are all quite aware that we are off to a tremendous start for the fall 2015 Tuesday evening season with a conversation between Kehinde Wiley and Dr. Eugenie Tesai. Dr. Tesai received her BA from Carleton College, keep me in line, in Northfield, Minnesota, and a PhD from Columbia University. Since 2007, she has been the John and Barbara Vogelstein Curator of Contemporary Art at the Brooklyn Museum, which is where, of course, Kehinde Wiley, A New Republic, began its tour before opening here this coming weekend. In her tenure at the Brooklyn Museum, Dr. Tesai has curated many important exhibitions, as well as beginning the museum's commendable Raw Cooked series devoted to emerging Brooklyn artists. Prior to her post in Brooklyn, Dr. Tesai was director of curatorial affairs at PS1 Contemporary Art Center in Queens, beginning in 2005, as well as having been associate director of curatorial affairs at the Whitney Museum of American Art. She also made a name for herself as an independent curator, conceiving of and organizing projects for various institutions, including the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, the Berkeley Museum, and the Princeton University Art Museum, receiving the International Association of Art Critics First Place Award for the Best Monographic Exhibition of 2005 for her exhibition, Robert Smithson. Kehinde Wiley is probably beyond introduction with this audience, but I will remind you that he is an international artist based in New York and Beijing who grew up in Los Angeles. Readily recognized for his, subversive historical paintings that borrow freely from art history while attaining contemporary relevance with what he has described as representation of urban black and brown men, and as we know, women, found throughout the world. After a BFA in 1999 from the San Francisco Art Institute, Kehinde Wiley moved to New York, where he received an MFA from Yale University in 2001, which was followed by what might be seen as a career-launching artist residency at New York Studio Museum in Harlem, with the inclusion in the Studio Museum's show Black Romantic, The Figurative Impulse in African American Art in 2002, and then the three-person, exhibition, Ironic, Iconic, both of which received a great deal of press, with Kehinde Wiley often singled out as a rising star. The rest is, as they say, history, a massively successful history that has received a massively successful history that is very much in process as it continues to gain steam with every series. each of the new series, has received an exhibition and accompanying catalog met with critical acclaim. As Deborah Solomon recently wrote for the New York Times, now 37, maybe 38, Mr. Wiley, Mr. Wiley is one of the most celebrated painters of his generation. So with that, please join me in welcoming Eugenie Tesai and Kehinde Wiley.
Can you hear me up there in the back row? Yes? Okay. Thank you all for coming here tonight. Needless to say, we're thrilled that Kehinde Wiley, A New Republic, is being presented here at the Modern Art Museum at Fort Worth. And I had a chance to walk through the show briefly before this conversation, and I have to congratulate Andrea Carnes for her beautiful installation. You are all in for a treat. And tonight, of course, is a special occasion and opportunity to hear from the man himself, our star, Kehinde Wiley. I'm going to ask him a few questions, and I have a few visuals. The visuals are merely a kind of taste of what you're going to see upstairs, a little tease. And then we'll have 10 minutes for questions from the audience. So here, I'm just showing you the cover of the catalog. Run to the store and buy it. It's really great. It has beautiful illustrations. And my first question for Kehinde is, well, I actually want to start with an image. I'm showing this image of the Huntington Library, where I went to visit last year after hearing that Kehinde had gone there as a child. And it was a pretty amazing place. So let's start at the beginning. Your childhood in South Central Los Angeles seems remarkably ordinary, but was clearly rather extraordinary. So tell us about that and how your interest in art evolved. I mean, when did you know you were going to be an artist?
Bear with me, guys. I have a little bit of a cough. So.
Kehinde's a little under the weather, but we're thrilled that he's still here with us.
We're going to get through it. No, I think that's a great place to start, and part of it is just because, as Eugenie, you've been to that space, it's not just the art on the walls. It's the experience of going through urban Los Angeles, getting off of the freeway, walking through these magnificent gardens, extraordinary Japanese gardens, extraordinary old-school English gardens, and then you walk into these halls where, for a kid like me who was studying painting at easily 11 years old. I'm looking at stuff now that, you know, I had never imagined people could achieve that level of mastery in paintings. Their collection has all of these 18th and 19th century society portraits, powerful landed gentry, a lot of powdered wigs and lap dogs. In the end, if coming from South Central LA and having the perspective and the experience that I had, sure, there was a gulf, I think, experientially in terms of understanding the trappings of social class and empire and all of that that's implicit in terms of what goes into making those paintings and their histories. I think what I was in love with more than anything was just the technical mastery of it. To be able to return to that conversation years later as someone who had finished his art studies and moved from just the sheer technical aspect of painting to the more conceptual aspects, that personal story, my own personal lineage, is throughout everything that you see, and it starts exactly here.
How did you get there? It seems very far from South Central. Did you go with your parents or with classes or school?
To the library itself.
In Pasadena, which, as you say, it's a little out of...
Well, actually, my mother sent me to art classes when I was 11 years old. And part of that school, it was a weekend class thing. And so it was me and my twin brother, and we would get on the bus. And it would take us about 2 hours to get from our home to art class on the weekends. And so it was 4 hours in traffic every weekend. But it was an opportunity for he and I to bond. to competitively make drawings on the buses together, but also to just get out of that environment. We were talking about the 1980s in South Central Los Angeles. I go back there now, and it's just completely different. I mean, it's just really hard to imagine psychically what kind of need there was to enhance your worldview. And I think I thank my mother every day for that. I mean, she was one of those crazy moms who would just come up with stuff. We didn't have any money at all. She was working on her master's degree at USC, but she was raising six kids as a single parent. We were just barely getting by, but she would find things like, you know, an all-Jewish summer camp, and it was like me and my twin brother. You know? And like we were the scholarship kids. And then there was when I was 12 years old, the Center for U.S.-USSR Initiatives, this is back in 1989 when there was a USSR, run by the Central Intelligence Agency, strangely enough, had this cultural affairs office, and they sent me, along with 50 other Americans, to Russia to study art and to study painting in the forest outside of St. Petersburg. Again, one of those things that you just don't expect of someone who happens to look like me from that place in that time. My mother created this strange little garden for us to grow up in where, sure, we were economically impoverished, but we were enriched in ways that you can't imagine. She started this fire, and it got me looking at picture making, got me looking at the seams of where identity lies, the cracks that lie between where I live and where I get bused to go to the school on the other parts of town, the social injustices that undergird the realities of everyday life, that later explain some of the realities of sugar plantations and cocoa farms and the amassing of wealth and the fashioning of gilded frames that then house major paintings of powerful people that hundreds of years later I'm revisiting and breathing some sort of new way of thinking about those people, that time, that struggle. But is it all angry black man stuff? No, I think oftentimes it just comes down to that sheer mystery, that love of painting, that looking at this thing and being like, wow, that's weird, but I really want to play this game somehow.
I'd like to see your work in the Huntington Library. So after you received your BFA in 1999 from the San Francisco Art Institute, you then left the West Coast to study at Yale University's Visual Arts Program, which is one of the most highly regarded programs in the country, and one that's perceived as a bastion of privilege. So how do you think your time at Yale shaped you as an artist, the artist you are today?
Good question. Yale's not easy. I mean, it's one of those places where
people crack up there.
Listen, I was right on that edge. You know? But I knew from the beginning that I wanted more than just your standard art school education. I wanted to be able to... I saw Yale as this insane buffet court of languages and of histories. And I threw myself not only into the painting department, but I TA'd for the art history departments. I ended up doing several courses of language study there and just really wanted to squeeze every bit out of the experience that I could, because I knew that I was just so improbably positioned here and that I really should value it as an experience, and I did. There is a social dynamic that you can't deny. The city of New Haven is a broadly black and brown town where the school itself sits like a citadel at its core. And, you know, as a graduate student, I'm expected to live off campus. And so there's this interesting thing with campus police where it's like, okay, are you supposed to be here on the other side of this wall? And so there's this strange navigating of the two worlds there. That said, it's that weirdness of experience that I think any artist can thrive on. It's a wall to throw yourself up against. It's a means by which you can measure what normalcy supposedly is, because that city was it was nothing short of a miracle. Fast forwarding, once I left there, though, it gave me also something to react against. I wanted to get away from all of the ideas that my professors had been teaching me, all of the competitive small dramas that were going on between this kid who thinks they're the next star and this kid who thinks they're the shit. It was just like really hard to imagine yourself outside of this group of peers. And what happens is the world will let you know very quickly that those petty concerns of yours were exactly that. Moving to New York, I decided to just sort of go into this space where I concentrated on space and place, where I was at the time, the streets of Harlem. I was at the Studio Museum in Harlem and got an opportunity to really...
Right after you got your MFA.
That's right.
I mean, you moved straight from New Haven to New York.
And I had no idea what I was going to do after school, and I got that call, and it was a perfect opportunity to throw myself into the studio again, but this time on my own terms. This time I started concentrating on a type of black masculinity that was oftentimes misunderstood or couldn't possibly be processed at Yale. Everything at the school was intellectualized to a point of sterility. And what I wanted to do was to sort of allow things to grow out of control, much like this sort of Samsonian hair.
Out of control. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so this is conspicuous fraud, and that's...
Right. This is actually the last painting I made at Yale for the final review, my sort of thumbs up on the way out. And it's called Conspicuous Fraud. And it comes from, I believe, 2001.
Mm-hmm. Right before you left.
Yeah. And what it was this outgrowth of very simple color theory stuff that I was thinking about quite a bit at Yale, and thinking about the ways that color functions socially. You have to realize that color is something that's so deeply coded in our society. You think about fast food, you think McDonald's, Burger King, it's always oranges and reds and yellows, never blues or greens. Fast food is always within that reddish range. Color, social. This is Martha Stewart's Seafoam Green from her 1999 home collection. What I wanted to do here was to sort of look at taste and that sort of very proper Connecticut sensibility fused with this sort of irrational hair. Thinking about hair in that biblical Samsonian sense, hypersexualized, color also playing a part in that. And this was obviously the first stab at what would later become a series of investigations of black masculinity.
And when you were at the Studio Museum, you devised you kind of rethought the whole notion of portraiture. And you came up with a technique that has come to be called street casting. I think that's a name you gave to it.
Yeah.
And which is a very unique form of portraiture, one that that really turns on its head the usual relationship between the power relationship between the artist and the subject, the person in power and the subject. In making this street casting, which is collaborative, which involves the participation, I guess we could say, of the subject, can you talk about how that came about? I have a picture of you here in a nice Yale hoodie on the street, and I think... this is a shot from Passing Posing, the exhibition that was at the Brooklyn Museum in 2004, which featured some of the works that used the street casting technique.
Right.
So how did that happen, radical?
Well, yeah, I was in Harlem. I was living my life in that studio trying to figure out how to make compelling work to me. And I was coming from Los Angeles, thinking about the very different sort of pedestrian energy. In Los Angeles, you're always in your car. You're always mediating space through that car. In Harlem, it was everyone in the streets all the time, densely packed. Saturdays, even more people, more fashionable, more peacocking, more sense of like personal self in the streets. And I loved it. I was fascinated with that energy. I wanted to be able to get that down in painting. I wanted to be able to look at the ways that fashion at the time were just constantly changing. You would see hip-hop music videos. Hype Williams was popular at the time. And that fashion would sort of rise and then decay within weeks, right? Painting is about...
It's like fast food.
That's right. That's right. And it's a very black American sensibility. You know, it's part of the sort of hip-hop thing, whatever that is. We don't know quite how to wrap our minds around whether or not hip-hop is just music or fashion or language or speech pattern or body movement or attitude. But in the end, it was the beginning of that in the culture, and I was very excited about it. But this sense about temporality within painting, this presupposition that art it will speak about the timeless. It will hold up to society all of those things that we value and want to see indelibly, is thrown into sharp relief when thinking about the type of social and aesthetic decay that occurs in fashion and in pop culture. And so for me, that was extremely exciting and dangerous. What I did was I just simply went out to the streets and I asked complete strangers to come upstairs and model for me. Most people said no. New York City, you know, it's just not happening. But at the same time, there was this, like, you know, you mentioned the Yale t-shirt. Oftentimes you'll see my examples of paintings and things, my own work. It's this like, I'm legitimate thing, right?
You showed them your...
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't wear big Yale t-shirts around. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say to people, like, okay, this guy's not, like, just some creep. These are actually projects that I think will become actually important paintings. I didn't know that at the time. I thought that I was simply putting myself out into the world and experimenting in Harlem. It was only later that I realized that, you know, I was touching a nerve somehow. I knew that I was touching a nerve for myself. I knew that by going into the streets and allowing people to become complicit in this project, by turning up the volume on things like the art history that I like so much. Well, let's get into that. I think I haven't really talked about how we made that leap, but... You know, I started off by inviting people to come into the studio, but then after a while, we began having conversations about my interest in art, about the art history books that were on my walls, about why someone would so wastefully spend their lives staring at these pictures and reproducing. But I think for the first time, I saw what I had devoted my life to from an outside perspective, and it seemed rather perverse to them. This is so wasteful. This, your life, you're up in here staring at these paintings and making these things.
But somehow you got them to participate.
Well, that's right. Well, so I opened up these books, and I said, well, I think they're fascinating. Why don't you show me your favorite pictures? And so it became this sort of relay race, this back and forth between the pictures that I admired. And then pretty soon I began positioning the subjects as the paintings that they then admired. So it became this same strange back and forth between taste patterns and so on.
And did you photograph them, or how did you...
Yeah, so no one's got the time to sit for a classic portrait. But photograph. But at the same time, though, I learned how to paint from life in the sort of classic way. And painting from photography presents certain unique problems. And opportunities. And I think that
So what are the problems?
The problems are that if I place my hand close to the camera, my hand becomes five times larger than the eye perceives it to be. If I photograph iridescence or luminescence of certain types, the camera simply can't see it. There are certain limitations. However, there are certain strengths as well. The ability that we now have with Photoshop and some of the new digital imaging tools to reimagine what was there. Most of the paintings that you see are men and women wearing what they happened to be wearing that day that I found them on the street. And then about 15% of them aren't. And those 15% are always going to be heightened or diminished colors. They're going to be throwing in elements to sort of make this painting shine in a way that plays with the original story, but you as the viewer never know if you're getting the original story or the authentic copy. I want you guys to have this sense of tension between what the real and what the imagined is, what the painting does and what the photo always has done is to present a world to you that is intervened with by the artist. The illusion that happens with photography, and since Photoshop and all of the new stuff, is we've lost that love affair with this perceived authenticity in the device. We now know, we're much more ironically attuned as audiences, that all of these are just small manipulations of our perceptions. I think it's important for artists to reintroduce that in their own work. I think it's important for you to think you're getting one thing and to never quite be sure exactly if this is it. But what I will tell you is that 85% of the time it is, but there's still a good...
So we should think about that when we're up walking through the show.
That's right. That's right. When walking through the show, there will be... models coming from small villages in West Africa. Years later, I would go on to work in other countries. But in that same show, there's a guy from Brooklyn, right? But you never know who that is. And I'm not telling.
Well, I am showing you the painting that's opening the show here, Wilhelm von
Huysen.
Okay, thank you. He's obviously the result of your street casting technique. And he's an example of what we think of as your early signature work, portraits of stylish young black men posed against these amazing decorative backdrops. And many people have remarked on the tension between the figure, which is so sculptural and so believably real, but kind of floating in space, and the flatness of the decorative background. Can you comment about that? They seem almost to be in competition, where you're like, the figure, and then you're like, oh, but, you know. And how do you hold them in balance, and do you regard them as a competition? Or
Surely. And I think you're getting to the heart of yet another one of my ploys in the work. The relationship between figure and ground is one of the most principal ones that exist in the art history, the history of art. The question is, where does the figure sit in space? The space, whether it be flat or dimensional, is always presumed to be a type of timeline. It's usually, in classical paintings, a male figure who's standing very erect and self-possessed in the foreground of a painting. He's perceived as being in the present tense, because in terms of pictographic space, the present tense would be referenced by the forefront of the picture. To that extent, the landscape itself becomes a timeline, a reference in terms of beginning, middle, and end, a way in which you can see yourself in the present and the past being behind you, oftentimes your land, your wife, your children. Everything that's considered to be a type of possession in this worldview is alive in this work. I think there's something problematic about that, and I have devised a language system in painting that destroys the landscape, that started with the field, the simple colored field that you saw in some of the earlier works, but then later became populated with these sort of decorative allusions to where these poses come from. If the pose was coming from the late French Rococo, then of course you would start to see late French Rococo filigree taking up the backgrounds. That wasn't enough after a while. After a while, it became clear that I wanted the background to start to be in direct competition with the figure. So the background is starting to move forward, demanding space in the painting. It becomes this kind of presentation of the background as a forgotten character, someone who's sort of underthought, undervalued, and non-presented. That same type of tension between black and brown bodies in the walls of museums throughout the world. There's also, I think, just the real technical...
So it's a metaphor, okay.
Yeah.
The metaphorical background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just tired of being stepped on some level. It's just like demanding to be here. but then the figure is sort of demanding space, so that back and forth. The body language is incredibly important in these paintings as well. If you remember the Van Huysen piece
Can we go back to the last... slide. Let's see.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. Oh, there you go.
So, if this is a big part of...
swagger.
Yeah, sure. This was considered to be the height of masculinity back then. You know, if you look at an old Van Dyck painting, or if you look at Franz Hals, you know, this sort of hand thrown backwards and this sort of effete thing, this was what powerful men did. When thrown in sharp relief with the black male body, I think we see it as something different. But, you know, signs and body language have always been misconstrued and misconstructed.
One of the most beautiful things, I think, about walking through your exhibition is the way the subjects in the paintings become performers, and they all react to one another as they hang in their galleries. It's quite remarkable. And so if you switch something around, then you have a different relationship. Well, you know, they have a different relationship, and it's like going to good theater.
Yeah. I rarely think about it that way. That's something that's interesting. You know what that brings up to me is the fact that oftentimes there's a bunch of guys and girls in the studio at the same time when I'm shooting. And so there will be this kind of, like, competition going on to see who's got the better pose, who's able to pull it off better. And, you know, some people really ham it up. And what you're looking at is me trying my best to stay true to that moment. And so the demonstrative aspect, that sort of, that thing that occurs there is real, mm-hmm. but it's a direct outcropping of competition in the studio.
Hmm. Now, I'm going to ask about the frames because I know people are going to ask. Your frames, which are so over the top, and so, I mean, do you think of them as part of the work of art? Are they intended to be an affirmation of the grand tradition of European painting, or a kind of send-up? And here is the frame around one of your equestrians, and it's very similar to the frame around the Fort Worth equestrian, Colonel Platoff.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, one thing you have to realize that in these paintings, there are these decorative caps. You can probably see it better in the golden version. On each of those, there's these type of ovaries stuck on the ends. On the surface of those are these sperm cells that are swimming across with them. And then, of course, up top is this kind of vaginal shape where my head is popping out.
We always wondered if that was a self-portrait. Maybe the only self-portrait of you.
That's the only time I've shown up in my work. All right, so there's a reason for all this stuff. So the frame is actually a means by which to sort of talk about a lot of the sort of charged sexuality that exists within the work. Hmm. There is presupposed by any exchange in which you stop a complete stranger in the streets and ask them to pose for you, the acknowledgement of a type of physical beauty. If that's a man to a woman, that's a very heteronormal exchange. If that's two guys, then it becomes this hyper sort of homoerotic exchange. But regardless of what it is charged. And within the history of art, there's this type of sexuality that exists within portraiture. People talk about female beauty in paintings quite easily. That's a very facile notion within painting. But I think to think about some of those great David and Ingres paintings as the denouement, the apotheosis of male beauty in painting, I think is a really important one. And we have a rule book for it, right? They've laid it all out there. Generally, what happens is that strength and domination with ease are the hallmarks of that. So if you, for example, try to make an equestrian painting such as this, and you did like I did and hired an actual horse, you would be misled, because actually the body in relationship to a horse is a lot more engulfed. The horse is actually much larger in relationship to the mm-hmm. body. I'm copying what David did, and David was making the male figure a lot larger. The horses are always seen as these sort of hyper-feminized mane, mm. these sort of very sort of violent, out-of-control things. It's a sort of irrational female presence. But then there's always this powerful man who, maybe with a pinky, is controlling everything. Yeah? The sexuality and the metaphors for sexuality exist within paintings, and I think it was important for me to to make that part of it and to sort of draw attention to the self.
It's almost like commentary.
That's
the frame's
right.
Almost like commentary.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then if you could please indulge us and just share with us the backstory of this incredibly striking, your Michael Jackson portrait,
mm-hmm.
Which stops everyone in their tracks.
Right. Well, before he died, Michael Jackson called me as it came, like I was a complete shock. He called the studio and I said, just ignore that because I thought it was just a joke. I thought somebody was like playing with me. Michael Jackson doesn't just call people out of the blue. And finally got to the truth of the matter. He had been doing a photo shoot at the Brooklyn Museum and saw one of my works.
It was Napoleon.
It was
hanging
Napoleon
in the lobby.
Yeah, that's right. That's so funny.
He liked it.
Yeah, right. And it was that last photo shoot he was doing for, like, think Essence or Ebony, the one where he looked like a white woman with a bob. He ended up getting in contact with the studio. We set up a phone meeting. We hit it off. A series of conversations began happening back and forth. Mailing of books, art history books, to various hotels. He would always be changing hotels.
Oh, he liked art history? He knew about art history?
Extraordinary mind for it. I remember actually talking about aspects of Rubens' later brushwork in relationship to the earlier work. I mean, aspects of painting that you just don't get from a more casual or pedestrian understanding of the work. And people don't really understand that about him. I didn't, certainly. And what came out of it was this interesting conversation about armor and how armor functions as both keeping something out and in, right? Armor as this thing that he had spent his entire life creating but was being sort of controlled and consumed by. There were some really amazing examples of armored painting in art history. We spoke quite a bit about this. This one's actually borrowing largely from a Rubens painting.
Was that at his request, or was that a no-brainer for you?
It was mostly me saying, I think this is where we should go. But it was also informed by all of those conversations that we were having before, surrounding the theatricality, the scale. It's all in there. So it's something that I rarely do, but I think that by making this thing, I was able to kind of get that feeling of what some of the artists back in the day felt like dealing with the church and with the state or dealing with the kings and so on. He's one of the few examples where I was actually like, ooh, I'm getting, you know.
But he never saw it.
Sadly, he died.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's now hanging in a museum in Germany somewhere. I forget.
Right. Well, that's where it will return after it makes its tour around the country. Yeah. So you're known as a painter, but one of the most exciting things that happened with this exhibition was the news that you were going to show new work, kind of new media that Kendi's working in. And of course, it wasn't like video. It was something really old, stained glass.
Right.
This is an installation of stained glass as it looked at the Brooklyn Museum. It's another kind of chapel structure here, a really beautiful dark green chapel that you enter. This one you kind of walked around.
Yeah.
So that was a huge surprise and a delightful one.
Yeah.
How long had you been interested in stained glass and why? Why were you looking back to...
It started just because of its radiance, its luminosity. In painting, it's light that bounces off the surface. It's you using this sort of colored paste, hairy stick, coaxing something into form, and then the light bounces off. With this, it literally emits light itself and enters the eye. It's the purest form of experiencing an art object, and it's something that can't be reproduced. You just have to be there. I first encountered the story of how it's being done today when I was strangely in West Africa. I was in Nigeria trying to find my father, and I saw some story on stained glass, right? And turns out that most of the stained glass comes out of these small little ateliers in places like Poland and the Czech Republic, largely Central Europe. And so fast forward many years, I jump on a plane and I'm in Novi Bor, this small town inside of Czech Republic, and I'm visiting studio after studio, trying to understand how we can sort of create something in my own aesthetic. The stained glass also draws very directly in terms of its rhetorical strengths on the religious. And I think that a lot of the society portraits don't quite give you the oomph that the religious experience does, particularly because within the religious, what we want to do is to recognize the sublime. And this is something that artists such as Caspar, David Friedrich have been very good at using. And one of the reasons why Friedrich as a painter has been so effective is because of his use of light. And the use of light in referencing the sublime is one of the oldest tricks in the book. It's the ways in which artists recognize that divinity itself is code for light and vice versa. When we think about the presence of God, it's always seen through light. And to that extent, this becomes a type of non-sacred look at things that we should perhaps hold in a little bit more concern.
Is that why you're interested in, for example, the work of Hans Memling and the small altarpieces and also the small icons?
The icons, definitely, definitely.
I mean, it's very striking, and again, you don't seem like a particularly religious person, but when you see these works in the exhibition, you're very struck.
That's right. And as you can see in these other smaller works, and I love how this conversation, you're doing this on purpose, right? It's just like flowing.
Yeah.
I love the way that there's this scale shift. And in this work here, in relationship to Hans Memling, the works are about yay big. And as opposed to them being these large, overwhelming structures that contend with you in physical space, it's you who dominate it. And it's it that feels a bit more vulnerable in the world. In order to make these paintings, I literally am painting on wood this time and painting in my lap, so with these small triple zero brushes. And so it's a much more intimate relationship with painting as well. This is a really great way of looking at the theatricality of light in exhibitions as well. Mm. The ways in which the presentation of it, nothing that I invented. I mean, this is all the sort of old presentation of museums past, allows for the work to have a type of halo so that it glows within the space by virtue of an overhanging light. In the case of stained glass, that glow it occurs quite naturally.
Well, if you painted these in your lap, then how did you make the stained glass windows? How were those created, those enormous complex?
Okay, so much like many artists over the centuries, I work in terms of having a studio in which I specialize in the things that I do well, right? So I'm a portraitist, and so in all of those paintings, you'll see a zillion little tiny leaves or something like this. My studio assistants are helping out with a lot of those leaves. I'm doing all of the people.
That's the Renaissance model.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. And I think for a lot of audiences, there's this illusion that the artist is going to sort of be doing every single thing.
But that's the 19th century model.
That's
the
right.
Romantic.
That's right. The reality is quite different. But I think what the new reality presents are new means to fortify your vocabulary. And to that extent, we are designing all of the stained glass on computer right now. I'm beaming to these ateliers in Central Europe what's been designed on the computer. They're starting to work on cartoons the small drawings of it. And then later, once they're in sort of midstream, then I fly out to sort of do color swatching where we get everything. So it's a much more sort of collaborative process than you might imagine. I'm not in the studio burning molten glass and pouring. But at the same time, I am in a way the sort of creative director of all of these other aspects of art creation that go beyond just the painting that I do every day. There's aspects of working within the field of art in a way in which it's a cultural presence, much more than just a simple material act. You'll see in this exhibition that there is all of the painting that you know well, but there is sculptural works, there's stained glass works, there's video works. A large portion of what I've been doing over the years is having camera crews follow me everywhere that I go in order to talk about what the process is.
Well, World Stage, which is a series you began in 2006 and is ongoing, and you took the street casting technique around the world. And it's already a very participatory, complicated process. So then when you travel, how does that complicate things? What does it involve?
Well, it involves a team. It involves lighting people and sound people. Oftentimes, you'll need to have translators because you're dealing with areas where English aren't spoken. And then there's just the fact that it's just a lot harder to communicate what in the world is going on. There's always been money that I pay my models
for
their time.
Has that been a practice you've done since the beginning?
Of course. I mean, you can't ask people to spend all afternoon with you. And, you know, people have lives and they have to, you know, pay their bills and stuff. But these are high-priced luxury goods for wealthy consumers, you know. It makes sense that all of that is part of the ecosystem there. Okay, so what happens, though, if you're in smaller villages, in places where if you're making payments commensurate to what I'm doing in other parts of the world, you start to create this sort of stampede thing, right? So then there's, like, security issues. It's greatly complicated. So over the years, I've evolved some practices, some best practices, and I've evolved ways of getting into situations where we can look at the art history of different places. And I'm not talking about just European painting. I'm talking about in West Africa. There's public sculpture that has existed for decades, most recently post-colonial sculpture that's in city centers. And using those images, those familiar images, as a means of recreating a personal story there, or a national story. The backgrounds are now based on West African textiles that I found in marketplaces and city centers. But oftentimes you'll see that sort of look and feel of a very urban American fashion aesthetic that sort of washes up on the shore of every major country and continent in the world. One of our biggest exports as a society is our culture. And in this generation in which young people can consume American culture everywhere, by and large, its inflection is one that's highly, highly tinted by the hip-hop and its look and feel. And so that's actually kind of become this sort of strange other sub-narrative in the work, the globalization of American hip-hop aesthetics. The secondary aspects, I think, within that have to do with me as an American in relationship to the world. So why certain countries? I chose Nigeria because of my own personal story, my father and that, and Senegal because of its direct relationship with the first sort of opening up of colonialism. Chose Israel because of its strategic and historical and cultural ties to the United States. India and Sri Lanka and China as these sort of and Brazil as these sort of major emerging markets. America and its way of looking outside of itself has so much to do with America and its own anxieties, whether it be cultural or economic or security-wise. And so this project starts to take on the contours of American anxieties.
I have to ask you one. This is Dogon Couple, and I look at it all. I've looked at it many times, and the young man on the right is wearing a medallion, a portrait medallion around his neck.
That's Senghor. Yeah. The first president of the newly independent Republic of Senegal.
And is that a common...
Well, what it is actually it's a kind of medallion that you would see for religious purposes. And so it's very rare to see a politician in one, which is why I was sort of drawn to it. But generally what you'll see are marabouts and imam inside of these little medallions that are hung around people's necks. And so it's what that young man happened to be wearing that day.
You didn't alter that
one. I didn't alter that one.
Thanks. And there you are, looking at fabrics.
Yeah.
And then here's Brazil. And this one, I just want to comment. You have another kind of mode of doing backgrounds, which is the natural, in quote,
right,
background, which looks like a stage set.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting based on, you know, in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to get to the women because, of course, in 2012, you surprised many of your fans by beginning to paint women. And I'm wondering why. The series Economy of Grace.
Right. And Economy of Grace was an opportunity for me to really get into something that had been a pet project of mine on the side. I wanted to get it right. I mean, I began my artistic endeavors by painting women. I mean, painting mostly nude women in art school.
Ah, okay.
And so, I arguably paint women in a way that's a little bit more sort of close to the sort of art student's non-professional authentic self, if that's ever impossible to talk about. But that gets me into weird territory because these were also nude white women, right? And so the question of like painting of black skin, the mastery of painting of black skin. Arguably, most of my life has been painting white skin. I think I might be better at that. But
that's a strange comment. Okay.
Well, no, I mean it's not strange. It's just the material fact of who the models are when you're in art school.
Okay.
Copying from the masters, and the fact that there's just not enough or that many classic paintings to use as an example as an art student. At any rate, what I mean to say is that there's a number of anxieties with regards to what I should be painting. And a lot of people have come up to me and asked me why I'm not painting women and why I'm not painting non-blacks for a number of years. And I've always wanted to do things my way. And my way had to do with what I'm passionate about. And in terms of the depiction of women in painting, I had always wanted to be able to turn up the volume on this kind of irrational beauty, this positioning of beauty as this comfortable space in which the women are positioned for the male viewer to sort of draw their eyes across the surface of the painting. In my work, what I wanted to do also was to look at kind of the trappings of fashion and hyper-elegance. So once again, we start to think about dress code, but here we're removing all of the urban stuff that we find in the city streets. And then I contacted Riccardo Tisci, the fashion director of Givenchy. So what I did was I actually went into the streets of Harlem and Brooklyn and Queens, and I found complete strangers in the streets, and then had these women measured by a couture house, by Givenchy, and had one-of-a-kind ball gowns made up. In this sense, what I wanted to do as well was to get into some of those like conversations around the exclusivity of this market, the sort of trappings of couture, trappings of the art industrial complex itself, never quite resolving any of it. I never wanted to create this kind of political corrective in which, as opposed to going this way, we sort of find it's polar opposite. No, we're running towards the problematic. We're running towards aspects of the representation that should be or could be critiqued, but recognizing that there's something sort of sickeningly sweet about it, turning the volume up on it to the point where it becomes these sort of interesting cages, these pleasing little devices. I'm not quite sure if art should resolve problems. I think at its best, what art is doing is setting up a set of provocations. And this is one of my favorite ones.
Well, that's a good place to end, even though there's so much more to speak about, especially if we want to leave time for questions from the audience. So why don't we do that?
Okay.
So,
the shoes. Not yours.
The shoes.
Why?
I can choose. Right. But, you know. Okay. All right. So, well, it's a good question. What's up with the shoes? What's up with the brands and so many of these paintings? It's not me. It's the culture, right? I mean, there are people who love brands, and I think that in more recently, it's kind of toned down a bit. But if you look at some of like the late 90s, 2000s stuff, I was just like logos everywhere. And I think that's just the nature of if you're doing this type of work, what you'll start to realize is the fashion decays really quickly. I mean, I went sometimes looking at some of like the velour Sean John suits, and it's like, did we really dress? Yeah, that was what it was. Yeah. But now I'm really excited about some of the new young up and coming designers who are making stuff out there right now. I was just in New York's Fashion Week this last week, and there's like this whole new thing that's out there, and it's always been that way. And I think
are we going to see it in your paintings?
Well, you're already seeing it. I mean, some of it. Not in this body right here, because that's capturing what that was. And then since, I've been off out into the world and doing, like, all these other countries. But back in America, meanwhile at the ranch, I think we might see something change there.
So after you graduated and were done schooling, how were you able to afford to move forward as an artist and launch yourself?
Right. That's a really good question. And like one of the scary ones that you have to deal with as an art student. And, you know, for me at the time, a lot of student loans. And no one talks about it in art school. There's just like this assumption that you're going to go out there into the world and like stuff's just going to work out. And that's just not always the way it is. What I did and what really worked for me was to look for artists in residency programs. And there's a number of them in large and small venues alike. And it's amazing how many there are out there and how many exist. So I encourage any of you guys who are art students who want to think about how to expand your craft and your practice beyond just the walls of a school. Artists in residencies are really great ones. There's the one in the Studio Museum in Harlem where I was, but they only accept 3 people a year. That said, there are residencies for women. There's residencies for Californians, Native Americans, you name it. I'm starting a residency in Senegal where I keep a studio. Recently, we've begun partnering with a number of art institutions to sort of pay back. I said, this is for me. This is a really core part of how I'm able to even do anything. So it means a lot to me to be able to build well over 20,000 square feet of artist and residency space on the coast of West Africa. What I do think, though, is that it should expand to not just the United States, but to Europe and to other parts. One of my friends runs an artist in residency in Beijing, And now you see tons of Americans and Europeans coming and going there. Continue your studies, but definitely pay attention to a lot of that.
Your choice.
You mentioned the impact of like hip hop and like culture and like the impact of it like in your work, I guess. I was wondering, do you listen to Drake?
Why?
Playlist.
Oh, okay. So he's like, I saw that you mentioned pop culture in your work. Do you listen to Drake? And yeah, of course. I mean, Drake is part of the soundtrack of being alive right now, right? And he's good at what he does. And it helps to hear that I'm one of his favorite artists. That's always edifying. But more than anything, pop culture and fine arts have begun to have like this really strange interface. Like, you know, Jay-Z doing Picasso Baby videos with Marina Abramovic, right? I don't know.
Your paintings appearing in the background of Empire.
Well, yeah. That's true. I mean, this little show called Empire that's on television now. And the paintings being in there, you know, when I first did it, people were like, are you fucking crazy? Your career's going to be over. This is like, you know, ghetto TV. And then... And now everybody's trying to get their work on this show, right? And every major musician, both peripheral and respected, it's become this sort of strange cultural phenomenon. The only reason why that happened for me is because I've always been a very sort of laissez-faire attitude towards this sort of this artificial wall between the art world and the real world, this sort of ivory tower mentality that a lot of artists and curators and art professionals have about the proper place for things. I think that's all an illusion. I think that we're all cultural practitioners of a certain sort, and there's good ones and bad ones. At its best, what I try to use pop culture and race and class and gender and all of that stuff as a color on my palette, right? Fusing all of these into different combinations. But good question.
I think we have time for one more. Your choice.
Oh, God, don't put it on me. How about you, way in the back?
Sleep 2008 is my favorite piece by you. Is it in this show, and how did that come about?
Ah.
Which one?
Sleep 2008.
Oh, yeah. No.
No, it's... No, it's not in the show. That painting came about because it was part of the Down series, and Down is a series of paintings where everybody's either dead or fallen or... Down. I mean, it's the direct opposite of those big heroic paintings. But it's interesting because it's a tradition of male portraiture that looks at the pathetic, the underside of.
But it's heroic.
And it's so heroic, and it's just so bad. It's good. You know? And so what I did was I sort of paired that, but with my normal practice. But what strangely happens once you start adding black male urban bodies into that is that you're sort of playing with this interesting intersection between what's going on today in America's streets, where there's the Trayvon Martins and there's these young, scared black boys and these fallen figures now take on a whole new resonance. And I had no idea what I was playing with. It was just like this mental exercise, art historically, conceptually, and then you stop and you're looking at what you've created, and it's just like, holy cow.
And I think you started it the year Obama was...
That's right.
I mean, that coincidentally, but yet that...
Well, it was started coincidentally then, but intentionally out of that interesting... rise in power and the thinking of presidency and national and state power, I've begun a show called Mr. President. And so far I've been to many African, sub-Saharan African nations sitting down with presidents, heads of state, going through menus of art history books, this time not just playing around with power, but actually dealing with sometimes beautiful, sometimes terrible personalities and talking about how do you want your picture crafted. And we're following with all the cameras, and I thought no one would ever allow me to get away with it, but people are saying yes, right? And I think part of it is the ego, sure, you know, the sort of adulation. But I think a lot of it also is just, sincere belief that that this work should bear witness to what some of the really great leaders believe they're doing right.
And when can we expect to see the
it's like herding cats, you know. It's a lot of, but give me a year.
Okay, I think we'll have to call this evening over. But I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and to thank Kehinde for so generously sharing with us.